Welcome to the Booktopia podcast, a podcast about books and the fantastic people who read and write them. I'm Ben Hunter. I'm here with Sarah McDewling, and our guest today is a voice you might be very familiar with if you subscribe to the Booktopia podcast. It's John Purcell, the author of The Girl on the Page.
John, it's so nice to meet you. Thank you so much for coming in today and making the journey.
Thank you for having me. It was a rigorous journey. It was across many feet to get here. So I've written this book. Have you guys read it?
Yeah.
I've read it. And we've heard about it for quite a while.
Oh, yeah.
I remember first hearing about this book. And at the time, The Girl on the Page was, I think you thought it was a bit of a jokey placeholder title.
I remember there was, both Sarah and I have worked with you for years now. And there was a time in all your brooding about the state of humanity and ranting about good writing and what it is and books today, there was this brief period where you seemed to grow a foot taller and a light came into your eyes.
And you seemed so happy.
And we were like, who is this new man we're meeting for the first time? And you told us, I'm writing again. And that was the genesis of The Girl on the Page.
Yeah, because it was a big, big gap between the publishing of the final book in the trilogy in 2013 and then all the way to 2017 when I really started writing again. That's
podcast
a big gap.
Podcast listeners, the trilogy is The Secret Lives of Emma.
I was being, yeah, okay, all right, fine. The Secret Lives of Emma.
Just in case you can people Google don't know.
Yeah. As I was a long time, I was working on another book altogether, a historical book, and it took up a lot of my time. I wasn't really writing. I was rewriting and tinkering rather than writing, which is, if you meet any author, playing with an old idea.
That's the hard thing.
Yeah, it's no fun, especially with no real path to publication either, so there was no sort of light at the end of the tunnel. And so when I decided to put that in a drawer, and that was, I think I first started that book like 7 or 8 years before. So it was a long process, and it was pretty hard to put it in the drawer, but I put it in a drawer, and this new book just came to me like so quickly, and I wrote it. You know, being here at Booktopia, where with a company that's growing so fast and so many people to look in the team, and all these authors coming through, and so many books to read, and trying to keep up with what's going on, it's a pretty full time job.
Yes.
So I really only had the weekend. So I had to my wife Tamsin and I had a bit of a chat, and I said, look, I really want to write this thing, but I'm going to have to be gone most weekends, at least for 4 hours each day, if I'm going to get anywhere with it. And so we sort of had a chat, and she really wanted me to get back into writing, because as you observed yourself,
it
makes me happy. So I did that on the weekends. And so from pretty much January 2017 to June 2017, I worked on weekends and wrote what is now The Girl on the Page.
Thank you, Tamsin.
Yeah, thank you, Tamsin. I can see why she's in the front of the book now.
Well, it also, one of the tricks to getting a writer to finish a book, because you know, lots of writers, you meet writers all the time, especially in the book industry.
Oh, yeah, everyone's got a book in them.
Everyone's got a book in them, but they're all working on it, and they never get to the end. They rewrite, like I was doing with the other book, and never getting to the finish point. And she had read bits and pieces of the other book, and read the same page with two words changed. Is it better now? Yeah, she was not going through that again. So she said, wisely, I'll only read it when you've got a big chunk of pages. When the first draft's done, I'll read it then. I'm not going to read any of your ideas. I'm not going to even talk to you about this thing. And so that drove me nuts.
You had to write it to get feedback.
I had to write it to get feedback.
Smart.
And so it was brilliant ploy. So I actually wrote the thing.
Fantastic.
Well, in many ways, you've lived a life that would inspire this book as your time as a reader and a bookseller. But there's also some other perhaps unexpected things that inspired the first, particularly the character of Amy. Would you like to talk about that, your various inspirations?
Yeah, well, so Amy was with me for years. While I was trying to write the other book, I stumbled across this idea for Amy. And it was Amy Winehouse that first popped into my head, because I love Back to Black, and I love the agony of that album and the darkness of it. But also, she's not perfect in it, and she's full of mistakes. Like the stories within the lyrics are full of her mistakes with relationships, with breaking people's hearts and suffering the consequences of not taking love seriously and all this sort of stuff. And I love it. I've always been interested in that. I mean, life is so complex, and love is so complex, and finding the right partner is so complex, and sex thrown in the mix is the devil, you know. It likes to mess with you. And she showed that so well in that album. And so Amy popped into my head as this character who was really great at a job, really great, and yet was failing, had done something terrible, and was sort of self-destructing in front of her eyes. But I didn't have a story for her. I had this great character. I mean, I'd love to write that character. So much like Amy Winehouse, who is so talented, so wonderful, and then destroyed herself with drugs and alcohol, but also then, which led to depression and all these other things came in. And it was just a massive tragedy. And I was attracted to that idea. And so Amy appeared, but I didn't have anywhere to put it at all.
So then how did it all come together? Where did you find her story?
Well, I started to think about these two older characters, and I've always been interested in older characters, the long-lived life and the experience there, and I've found that very attractive. And there have been lots of novels that I've read over the years, and I've always sort of been drawn to the older experience. And so in my bookshop life, in my life in the secondhand bookshop, which I was in for 15 years before coming to Booktopia, I met a lot of these really wise older people. They were my professors and my lecturers to the university called Secondhand Book World. And they would inform me. They were the ones who were creating a bridge between me and 50 or 60, even 100 years before me. And so they would talk about books that were written in the 30s if they were just out. And they would be talking about the books their parents read in the 19th century as if they were just out. And they were fresh and they were alive, and they gave these things to me. And I loved talking to them. And most of my recommendations that I would give to customers had come from these older customers giving to me, and me doing what they said, like reading Daniel Deronda. You know, why would anyone read that? But yeah, something in there I'm reading it. Or The Meritus, The Egoist. Or one guy gave me this marvelous old man who used to come into the shop at the slowest speed possible. It would take him 10 minutes just to walk from the door to the counter to talk to me. And he was a fan of John Cooper Powers, who most people don't read anymore, and he was kind of a 1930s writer. But Picador had these big paperbacks of it, and they were still around the secondhand market when I was there. So I was able to experience this, and it was only through him. I would never, I probably would not know now if I hadn't had this guy telling me to read it. And I feel enriched by that recommendation, and I went right through. So those kind of people were around me, they were there, and I loved them. And so having an idea of Malcolm, who's a literary giant, and Helen, who's a literary giant, living together, being married. I like the idea of a Julian Barnes marrying an A.S. Byatt, living together, and always really critically acclaimed, but never actually making any money out of it. So, and I met a lot of them, like a lot of people who were academics, who were journalists, who were thinkers and writers, who were living always on the edge of existence because they were doing a job which was, it didn't really bring in the bucks. And so Malcolm and Helen were in my head. I loved them. I fell in love with them, but I didn't have any story for them. And then they met. Amy and Malcolm and Helen crashed into each other, and suddenly had this novel. Bang.
It's so perfect.
It happened overnight. It was just one of those sparks of inspiration.
And how long, once you started writing, did it take for you to finish?
It was 6 months on those weekends. So I quickly drew up this little plan, which was about 2 pages long, and I showed it to Catherine Milne at HarperCollins, and it was really only 2 pages long. We'd been talking about my other book and the like, so I had a conversation with her going. So when I showed her, she said, "Don't worry about the other book. This is where it's at." And I said, "You really?" And she went, "Yeah, really. This is where it's at. This is so you. You should be able to write this so quickly and get this done." And it was. It was just everything from my new experience at Booktopia and my old experience at the secondhand bookshop, and all my old reading
clashed,
bang, and this book came out of it.
Perfect storm.
That's fantastic, especially that she just had that immediate faith in you, even though you'd just really been in the dark for all those years with that other thing.
Yeah, no, she saw what was valuable in the book that I just couldn't get going. And so she knew I could write. And when I gave her the idea, she could go, you could do this. So I really thank Catherine for giving me the courage and the stamina really to go and do this. Because, you know, if you've been out, that's, you know, 5 years or something of obscurity, be able to come back with such confidence. You need someone on your side, and Catherine was that someone.
That's awesome.
The thing that's interesting about this is that you're a debut author, but not.
Yeah.
So, like, this is the first book that you've sort of released with your name on it. How does it, like, what's the difference? How does it feel, like, compared to when your first book in the trilogy was coming out?
It's so more real. This feels like it's really me, and that if people don't like it, it's because I wrote it. Because Natasha Walker was like this fake person that I created, and she published 3 books. I didn't know. If you don't like it, well, it's Natasha's fault. It's not my fault.
There's a barrier of protection.
And I loved that. It gave me and because also I didn't have to do any of the, because no one knew that I was writing them, and they went out into the market without any me visiting bookshops or talking on radio or anything like that. They just did what they did. I was able to be a little bit distant from it. And so, even when I read the, like, there are really bad reviews on Goodreads and foreign websites like Goodreads in Poland and in France and places like that. Mm. They just ripped me to pieces. And I could read them with joy because I just thought it was so funny that people were reading, for one, and they would complain about reading the full trilogy and complaining each way through. I'm going, if you didn't like it, why'd you read 2 and 3? But, it gave me a definite bit of distance from those, but this is nothing like that. This feels like I'm just going to walk out naked into the main street.
You need to stay off Goodreads for a while, right?
Yeah, well, publicist Alice has just warned me. She said it's probably a good idea for your sanity to unplug from Goodreads.
I mean, I've been on there and it's overwhelmingly positive, but yeah.
I mean, well, we've been charting a range of reactions to this book throughout its coming into being through the ARC copies and the very early sort of PDF drafts that you sort of fed out to, you know, your trusted readers. And it's been very interesting to watch. This book has really struck a chord with people. There has been some really warm and positive glowing reviews, and there's been outrage and from Sarah...
I was outraged.
There was violence.
I was broken. I was reacting like a wounded animal. Like... It's you know, to be clear, I really like the book, but yeah, it packs a punch, and it's emotionally all, like, you know, we could talk about there's darkness in this book and there's tragedy in this book. There's also loads of humor, and there's also, knowing you, John, a surprising amount of hope. I feel hope and love.
Yeah, I tried to hide that, but you
get a big burst of hope, yeah.
It's an extraordinary experience to, you know, because Work John is grumpy man and generally responds to emails with one word and then produces this devastatingly beautiful, like, emotionally rich book. I don't know. Like, it took me ages to write my review, which isn't out in the world yet.
I couldn't even really make a review. I just had to write an endorsement.
Well, it's a story that means a lot to anyone in the book industry, but it's also a story that if anyone in families and anyone who has kind of difficulty opening up, you know, or who has either damaged or self-harmed themselves in some way and has difficulty in opening up, the basic idea around it is that clash between the youth and age, the literary and genre, commercialism and integrity and art. You know, these are all at war in my book. So it's been interesting to read some of the reactions to it, because I'm getting the feeling that there's two books. There's a book which is centered around Amy, who's this hotshot editor who's made a fortune by helping a kind of a dodgy thriller writer make it big and become a Lee Child kind of guy, pretty much turning him around. And they both make a lot of money out of it. But she likes the editing side of things, so she keeps going there. And then I've got the other side with these two literary greats who are, in their own trouble right now, because Helen has been offered a fortune, absolute fortune, for a book that she's not that proud of, a book that is kind of, she's written on purpose to make the fortune. And so her husband is kind of, he's kind of trying not to lose respect for
he's
that decision.
Disillusioned.
Yeah, disillusioned. Because they've lived like that for, with integrity
like,
for so
like
long.
This person that's been with him this whole time has just suddenly gone on holiday.
Yeah.
And they made this pact that this is how we live our
life. And it's incredible to read that they're moving to this big, expensive London house for the first time in their, you know, decades together. And he can't relax. He can't be, you know, there's this elderly man in this palace in London and he can't be happy.
Yeah.
It's,
And he's also going through stuff with his own career at the same time.
Mm.
Yeah, because right at the beginning of the book, the end of the first chapter, you discover that Malcolm has been long-listed for the Booker Prize after all these years of not really being fated in that way as an author. And for someone like Malcolm, it's ironic because he's not the kind of writer that would want that kind of accolade in the first place.
Yeah, and we were looking at the book shortlist today, and Malcolm is just not the kind of author that's going to fit in with this crowd that seems to be taking over now.
Yeah, no, and he's not comfortable with that stuff. He's not comfortable with the modern world. And what I was saying earlier, it's interesting that I've got two books. I've got Amy, people who love the Amy story,
mm-hmm.
and there are people who love the Malcolm and Helen story.
I don't know. You can't love them both in tandem equally.
Yeah, but it's interesting to see that the people are kind of siding, or at least seeing the book through Amy's eyes and seeing the book through Malcolm Helen. So there are people who are looking at through Amy's eyes at Helen's decision and going, well, that's of course the right decision to make. Why wouldn't you take the cash? Come on.
Where did you fall then?
I find this interesting. I think if I had to read, you could not write a book as successful as this book is going to be. I'm confident in saying that. You've just followed one of those paths.
Yeah.
It's the collision that makes the story.
And you didn't feel yourself falling on one side or the other? I'm trying to be honest. I think I'm on an Amy side of things.
No,
which is not to say that I'm not obsessed with Helen and Malcolm, because I am,
yeah.
But I think I guess I was viewing the whole thing sort of through her side.
Well, this really challenged me. I mean, Sarah and I can vouchsafe that a lot of the ranting that John does around the office is particularly resonant with Malcolm and the incredible things that he says in
this
book, which are at times hilarious, at times profound, but very frequently profound, in my opinion. But, you know, I mainly saw Malcolm as this John-like character. But the whole crew here is... You've got a lot of love for all of these characters,
John. I do. I was smashed
up. And there are parts of you in each of them.
Yeah.
I guess I'm not surprised by any of those parts, really, because I know Emma. So, like, Amy didn't come out of left field.
Yeah.
Like, I know that you can write women. But I guess reading it, you do feel more often when Malcolm says something, you're like, there's John.
Yeah.
But also it's really easy to forget. And that's, like, that's one of the things that I remember. I read it so quickly, and I started it late at night, which is dumb. And... because then I had to, like, fly through and it was so late by the time I finished. And that's when... And I did come into work the next day furious with you. But, like... and now I've forgotten my train of thought. But I guess, reading it, I had my moments of being, like, when Malcolm would say something, being like, yeah, there's John. But also for most of it, I was just lost. Like, I was in the story, forgetting who had written it, forgetting it all, just living it.
Mm. No, you've... You've written two difficult women, which is I found fantastic to read. There's a lot of people talk about the pressure on authors and story makers to write women who are likable in fiction and in film and everything. And you've just gone out on women and created these characters who are really testing and really complex.
But so vulnerable. And I think really, when you're a likable character, really is less important than a relatable character and someone that like pulls your heartstrings. And like, there's such vulnerability in these characters. Like, you just feel for them so much. And I'm getting mad again. So now what?
I mean, this thing with the two books, as you kind of put it, yeah, the Malcolm and the Helen and the Amy, it almost, for me, it almost correlates to these two sides of your career in books and bookselling. There's John in the wilderness as a secondhand bookseller living hand to mouth for years.
Black Books John, as I like Black to Books think John, of it.
wearing a t-shirt, playing loud music, and
being cheerfully as rude as
smoking
you would like to
cigarettes.
Be.
And now there's John, who's the same guy, but he's wearing a button-up shirt and he's in a corporate office, with a big car. Not like a really flashy car, but a big car, because you're a big guy. And you're suddenly, walking through the corridors of major publishing houses, getting invited to dinners that you'd never get invited to, awards nights. You're meeting Leon Moriarty and Michael Robotham and celebrity authors. You know, we're going to have Shane Warne and all these kinds of people, like people you would never meet in
It's
Mossman.
Actually really the perfect petri dish to create the girl on the page.
Like, well, I'm thinking if I had stayed in that bookshop and if I had written this book from the perspective of Helen and Malcolm only, it would not have what it has now. Mm-hmm. I had to go out, break out of my little happy place where everything was, I knew everything and I felt comfortable in it and everyone was dead. You know, it was really quite safe. And then go into the other world where I was not comfortable. I don't like going into rooms with people in there. I have to force myself to go into these events and talk to people and try to remember people's names and all that sort of stuff. And if you'd asked me way back when, I need to sell to James Patterson so that I can pay my next rent. And so I do that. And when I've sold enough, I don't sell them again. You know, and then until the next time I need to pay my rent, then I kept selling him. Now I'm in a world where I'm discovering just how many different kinds of readers there are and different kinds of people there are and different approaches to books and to literature and to history and to genre fiction and the whole thing. And I've kind of had my brain cracked open by this new world to allow more in, because I was a really closed cul-de-sac in that bookshop. I was a very safe place and yes, it wasn't really good for my imagination.
Yeah. And strong opinions were formed.
Yeah, very strong opinions. And when I think of them, sometimes I have that moment of shame, how strong. But I've learned so much more about all these different people. Like, we are very lucky here, and we get to meet and talk to quite. We have hours with these people that people line up and get 5 seconds at a signing, yep, with their favorite author, and we sit around chatting while they're signing, and then we have podcasts and we have all this time, and they're so open about their own processes and about how they think about the world. And so you can't see a Matt Riley novel and make a judgment about Matt Riley. Yeah, I would have done that in the past.
Yeah,
I can't do that now. I can't do that with any of these books. I know just how how much Matt Riley thinks about everything he does, and all these different authors, so many different authors that come through. There's so much going on behind the page.
Yeah.
That we just don't, we make great grand, I made grand statements about them, and I proved myself wrong by existing with them and meeting them. And so I've kind of chastened. And that side of it has come into the book.
It's present in the book. The question of what is literature is running throughout the whole of this thing. And what is the value of literature versus the value of, I don't want to say genre fiction because I don't like that division, and we've discussed it here as well, that like genre fiction can be literary. So but basically what the value inherent is in a book that may not be termed literary versus something that is literary.
Yeah. And for me it pushes beyond the literary. I mean, yeah, you've got Helen and Malcolm who are in this sort of Man Booker Prize-ish world. But it rings true, this argument about authenticity and what is value in storytelling. And I think you and I see this in everyone who comes in here. It's not just Tim Winton and Michelle de Kretzer. It's your celebrity biography author. It's your cookbook person.
There's a lot of craft that goes into
Eddie Wu was just in here, and he uses stories to teach math.
Yeah, and it's
also about what makes money, and then you're faced with the decision of which way do you go, and is there an evil way, like. To set out to write something that will make money, is that bad? Like
every time you publish something, you are selling yourself. We're doing it right now with this podcast, and all of these people, no matter where they're coming from, have to make these value calls all the time of how far do I go, and how do I stay true to the essence of what I am.
And these and questions.
What do I really have to offer the reader, the person's going to be on the other side?
And these questions are raised in the book, which again goes back to you say you've written two books, and I think that that's true in more than one sense. So you've got your Helen and Malcolm on one side clashing up against Amy's story. But you've also written what is a really, like, dynamic page-turner. Like, I flew through this in, I think, 3 or 4 hours. It's a page-turner book. It's a commercial book full of all these huge ideas that you would normally find in a really literary novel. Was that your intention, John?
Yeah, well, what I was trying to do, because I like the character of Amy at a glance is a kind of a caricature. You sort of go, this is a kind of a character that walks out of a Jackie Collins novel and into mine. You know, she's beautiful, she's intelligent, she's got all this going on, she has wonderful sex, all the things,
yeah.
And so she's my, you know, she represents commercial fiction, not only in what she does in her job, but as she is as a person. And I wanted to make sure the opening of my book was as inviting to as many readers as possible. And it's kind of like a funnel book. The opening's big and wide, which worries me a little bit, because I would like people who generally read, you know, modern literature and stuff to pick it up as well, because there's something in it for them as well. But I really wanted to encourage people who wouldn't normally read a book. If I was in a bookshop and said, it's a book about books, and they went, boring, I want to read about crime, or I want to read about this. I wanted them to come in. So I needed to make it as inviting as possible.
Wielding all the tools.
Yeah. So in my head, it made perfect sense to have Amy, drag people into the story, because she is
the glamour, the fast cars, the sex.
Yeah, and she represents the commercial side. So her story is very present at that beginning bit, and the Malcolm and Helen story starts a little bit slower. And then as they meet, as they clash, there's a change in gear, and I'm slowly turning the book as I go, even though that I keep the pace up. I introduce more ideas as I go into it, and more complex questions are raised as I go into it.
And it is complex, because if you think listening to this that you're going to get lectured about what literature is, that's not the case at all. You might come out of the book with more questions than you had going into it, but you'll come out thoughtful about what you read and about what we buy.
It's this brilliant. It's so light on. It's not heavy. You just fly through the book, and then you come out
and just with these
absolutely
moments,
awestruck about, like, how did I get here?
Setting it in the world of, like, the literati. I've been waiting all podcasts to say that word. you know, in this world where people are, like, you know, making speeches, gives you such a great forum to make these speeches. Which, as a reader, some of them were just blowing my mind. Like, there were some that were so good, I just wanted to clap. Like, without ever being lectury. Like, I actually think it's extraordinary what you've done. And, yeah, you know, you're our boss, and so maybe we have to say that. But I just want to really stress, we don't have to. We've been going 10 minutes longer than we normally go on these podcasts. And I'm not done, are you?
Yeah, no, I want to talk all about the salacious stuff in this. And, you know, there's a real-life all-star cast of A-grade
all
authors.
The people who are in it, like the real people.
Real people. And scandalous stuff is going on all around them. Was there people you had to sort of read? How's he going to get away with this?
Well, it was fine right until the last minute. And then HarperCollins went, right at the last second, they went, perhaps we should We should talk to the authors. Because they'd had advice that I hadn't said anything bad about anyone that was living. And so they didn't have, but they said, probably polite, John, just to sort of let people know that they're in a book. You know? So I had to, like, it's funny because at the last minute I had to sort of scramble around and try and find contacts for all these authors that are in my book and write to them saying,
Were you surprised by any of the responses?
Yeah, well, Kathy Lett was hysterical. She just comes back as long as I'm hot and I'm sexy and I'm an absolute genius. You've written me like that, of course. I'm fine. Yeah. Michael Robotham. I love Michael Robotham. I just love him. I love his writing. I love what he does.
We all love Michael.
And in the book, it was a book launch, and it was his book launch that Amy attends. And so I got to praise Michael Robotham on Pages, right? And he's a humble man, and he doesn't like that. So
I think he also wanted to, endorse the book, and felt that he couldn't if it was full of praise of him.
Yeah, but I also found he's a private man and a shy man, so he kind of went, look, do you mind? And so I switched it around, and because Val McDermott's at the launch, and so I switched Michael Robotham and Val, so it's Val's launch. So then I had to contact Val.
She was cool.
So I sent the whole chapter to Val McDermott through Hachette in Australia, and they came back to me. Oh,
so cool. Fresh off of Judging Man Book or Authors, yeah, just yeah. reading you.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was fun. So I wrote to nearly all of them. I could. Some I couldn't get a hold of, but I've got, I got the attempt there. Yeah.
Is it weird for you? Is it weird? I mean, I know you've done it before, but as we discussed, not as openly.
Yeah, after having been on the other side of the facade, you know.
Yeah, where you got to sell the book anonymously for a while. Like, I don't know, is it strange to be so much a part of every kind of side of this process?
It is. It was very strange right at the beginning when we had to go and my agent and I had to go and sell it to the publishers. So normally an author goes into a publishing house and the people around the table in the publishing house are all new. They've just met them. They're strangers. And all this magic happens, right? The publishers impress them with their, especially if it's a sought-after book, they impress them with what they're going to do for it and stuff like that. And I sat down at this table and I knew every single person at the table.
So you couldn't really suddenly sell yourself as
And they couldn't else. They couldn't do the magic dust over me because I had seen it all before. I knew each one of them and I knew the mechanisms. Like, what goes in the sausage. I knew what goes in the sausage.
Yeah.
And so that was odd. And then in here, because every author that comes through, where we come down and we do the signing and we talk to them and we do podcasts. So my daily life, even as we go into publication, is still going to continue on. I might go out and do like a couple of visits to other bookshops myself and then have to come back here and interview Marcus Zusak. You know, it's one of those. I'm not going to ever be on one side or the other. I'm going to always be in the mix somehow.
Well, I think
it's
going to
be good for your sort of psyche. I mean, you're going to be exhausted, but I think it's going to be good to sort of jump out of one skin and into another.
And yeah. I just don't think this book could have happened without that.
No, that's the thing. It has been written by this big churn, all the different ideas and different experiences over the last 25 years.
I mean, you've been, as you say, you've been in books in Sydney for decades, for 25 years. You know the booksellers, you know the authors. Now you've seen the inside of major publishing houses. In the book, you discuss this phenomenon of publishers, major publishers sort of merging and letting go and moving away from an old guard of risk-taking publishers who are looking for great work and not thinking about the money to the sort of new generation of younger, more corporate bean counter types who have sort of lost their way. Is that true of what's going on today? How is the health of our literary life? Are we heading towards a catastrophic iceberg? Did we hit the iceberg 15 years ago? And like everyone's just ignored the fact that we're about to drown or have already.
Well, I take Helen's position, and Helen, quite early on in the book, this comes up, and Helen reminds Malcolm that this happens all the time. Don't you remember the 80s? She said, that money people come in, they dismantle publishing houses and take out all the talent. And then wonder why they go broke. This stuff happens all the time. It happens in all businesses, all corporate businesses. They look for you know, what's the cheapest way out of this? What's this person over here do? We don't know. Nothing fits on the spreadsheet. They're out. And they realized they got rid of the publishing director that had contacts with every author that was in the place. These things are happening. It happens all the time. You can feel it. There are mergers, between massive publishing houses, and it affects everyone right down to, the reps that visit shops, and affects the shops because of the relationship. It's awful. And it's business. Business does this. And they make decisions based on, the bottom line and not realizing that, one individual is different from another, and had a much greater impact on the business than they could see from, the bits of piece of paper in front of them, because they had never actually had talked to them or knew them. That is happening, and that has happened over the last 10 years of being in Booktopia. There have been a number of big, you know, mergers and reshuffles and restructures within the publishers we've dealt with. Some have gone, like some have just disappeared. You know, they've just, one day they're all gung-ho and the next day they're not there. And that can be devastating for anyone who is published by that company. Because
but then on the other side of the coin, I guess there are others that have ballooned out and have grown massively, then they're finding new stuff and supporting Australian authors.
Well, when I first got involved with books, you wouldn't buy an Australian writer. Like, it just wasn't done. So it was, 25 years ago, if you were an American writer and a blockbuster, you'd be sold. If you're an American literary author, you'd be sold. If you're an English literary author, you'd be sold. And most of the history that was coming out was European or American history on the shelves. Most of the cookbooks were done by people overseas. It was very much a market where everything was imported in. And now we're in the beautiful situation of exporting Liane Moriarty and dominating the world. Like, we've got writers out there and in all areas of publishing who are publishing out into the rest of the world. And, you know, this has been a big shift within the Australian public's decision making. You know, they're choosing to read Australian produced books, but also the publishing world going, there's money to be made in selling Australian product, Australian readers. And so, you know, it's been glorious to see over the last 10, 15 years, a titanic shift, you know, massive movement of the whole business of publishing within Australia, focusing on local authors and local talent. It's been brilliant.
And now we've got you.
And now I'm going to ask you, John, the question. We've asked so many countless authors who have come through here. What's up next?
What's up next? I would love to write another book about books. I love books about books. I'd love to. There's so many things I can write about. And I've had an old man in my head for years. And I remember reading the 100-year-old man climbs out the window going, damn you. you stole my old man. But my old man, after thinking about it, is a bit different. And I've been talking to him lately in my imagination and wondering what he's up to and whether or not he could be dusted off and to insert into a novel. I haven't got someone else yet, so it's a while off, but definitely around books and the power of books to unite communities. That's,
would it have secondhand books selling in it?
It may have.
Oh, that would be fantastic.
I very much look forward to this.
Well, in the meantime, we implore you, listener, to pick up and read The Gone, the Page. And all of the books that John recommends throughout this book, no matter who you are, whether you're someone like Sarah and I who's read quite a bit, or whether you're someone who only reads one or two novels a year, this book will, like, hit you and strike you to the core.
It will give you a reading list.
And it will give you a massive to-be-read list. And it's worth it. It's $32.99 just for that.
Some of the books that you might want to read when you finish it don't exist outside the pages of the book, which I'm mad at you about. But
want to read the fictional...
I want to read the books that the fictional authors have written.
Oh, that stuff's too dangerous. It's too good.
But also, there's plenty of other... There's just so... I would defy anyone to read this book and not walk away with a mental list of books that they want to read.
And the great bonus of the finished copy actually has physical lists.
I wasn't going to say that because I wasn't sure if that was a spoiler. But yeah, That's full extra content.
Anyone who picks it up in a shop will go, "Whoa, hello!"
Like character themed reading list.
Yeah, it's incredible. John Purcell is the director of books at Booktopia, and he is the author of The Girl on the Page, which is published by HarperCollins Fourth Estate, and you can buy it right now. John, thank you for joining us. Thanks for being a guest on your own podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you can buy The Girl on the Page from booktopia.com.au right now, as well with all of the other fantastic books that we've been talking about.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.